The Roswell incident, Charles Burlett. Tell me you've read it. What? Well, we'll see if we can get some Sunday. You can stop taking calls for a while. Berlitz is an interesting writer. This was written 1980s. It's been around a long time. According to UFO legend, an extraterrestrial spaceship crashed in New Mexico in the early days of July 1947. This would seem to be on the surface simply another report that has been kept alive in UFO journals and the thousands of books written about UFOs in all languages. What is different about this case, however, is the vitality of this one single incident and its continuing developments in scientific, government, and legal circles. At the time this book goes to press, a civil action has been brought by concerned parties, Citizens Against UFO Secrecy, through their attorneys, against the CIA for the purpose of releasing information about crashed UFOs in accord with the terms of the Freedom of Information Act. CAUS, in addition, has taken over a previous suit of the Ground Saucer Watch against the CIA. Among the charges brought by the suits are suppression of media information, withholding of files, muzzling of witnesses, and in general, hiding information through the use of now unnecessary security classification. Events which had been reported in the press and by radio before security regulations were imposed by the Army Air Force, whose name was changed to the Air Force in that very year, 1947, indicate that material from the wrecked UFO was shuttled by high-security government transportation from base to base, and that the remains of the UFO and the dead occupants, one of whom was reportedly alive when found, are under high-security guard at CIA headquarters at Langley, Virginia. While much has been written about UFO sightings and encounters on Earth, little has been openly written about encounters with UFOs in space exploration. A rather convincing indication of the presence of UFOs in Earth space, and how far do those boundaries extend, has been furnished by mathematician, physicist, and author Maurice Chatelaine, a designer of the Apollo spacecraft and former chief of the NASA communications for the Apollo lunar missions, and an outspoken documentalist of one special phase of close encounters in space by explorers, U.S., from Earth with entities from elsewhere. According to Chatelaine's accounts, some of which are based on information picked up from inside sources while working for NASA in the 60s, and other relying on data passed on to him later by friends and former colleagues, reports of these encounters made during flights in space. They've been generally censored, altered, de-emphasized, or simply ignored by NASA, and therefore never reached the public at the time of their occurrence. The fact that the astronauts were on military duty was, according to Chatelaine, a great and perhaps planned advantage for secrecy, inasmuch as they could simply be ordered not to discuss aspects of their UFO encounters. Although the majority of U.S. astronauts are no longer on active duty, they have steadfastly maintained a discreet silence on this topic right up to the present day, leaving us with only Chatelaine's inside accounts to hint at what might really have gone on in space and even over the surface of the moon. These, to say the least, are visibly impressive. The following table is detailed in chronological order. spacecraft and date. Mercury, May 16th, 63. Crew, Cooper. Incident. Over Hawaii, picked up voices on special frequency speaking in language later examined on tape and found to belong to no known Earth language. Passing over Perth, Australia, and Joshak, go up and work with the sound because I got too much bass in it. Passing over Perth, Australia, saw a large UFO, also observed a checking station on Earth. Spacecraft date, Gemini 4, June 3rd, 64. McDivitt White, the crew. Incident. Over Hawaii, almost collided with silver cylinder, oval with luminous trail. Photographed it. Spacecraft date, Gemini 7. December 4th, 1965. Crew, Borman, Lovell. Incident. Took pictures of enormous UFO with propulsion systems following capsule. Spacecraft, Gemini 9. Date, June 3rd, 66. Crew, Stafford, Cernan. Incident. Capsule accompanied from takeoff by many UFOs seen by ground personnel as well as by capsule crew. Spacecraft, Gemini 10. Date, July 18, 66. Crew, Young, Collins. Two UFOs followed and disappeared when capsule asked ground station for radar observation. Later, a huge object, not a planet or planetoid, was observed. Too cold in here. Spacecraft, Gemini 11. Date, September 12, 1966. Crew, Gordon and Conrad. Incident, long object sighted over Madagascar. NASA said it was Soviet Proton 3, but that was 350 miles away at the time of sighting. Spacecraft, Apollo 8. Date, December 21, 1968. Crew, Borman, Lovell, Anders. Incident, sighted disc-shaped UFOs as capsule circled moon. Reported, quote, we have been informed that Santa Claus does exist, end quote. Also picked up unidentifiable language on space frequency radio. Spacecraft, Apollo 10. Am I boring you?
Sir.
I thought we'd have some fun with this tonight. May 18, 1969. Crew, Stafford, Young, and Cernan. Incident, sighted two UFOs following capsule during orbit of moon and homeward flight. Spacecraft, Apollo 11. Date, July 16, 1969, the moon landing. Crew, Armstrong, Collins, and Aldrin. Incident. Prior to the first moon landing, two UFOs and a long cylinder hovered overhead. When Apollo 11 landed inside a moon crater, two unidentified spacecrafts appeared on the crater rim and then took off again. Aldrin photographed them. Pictures have not yet been released by NASA to the public. Spacecraft, Apollo 12. Date, November 14, 1969. Crew, Conrad, Gordon, and Bean. Incident. Observatories on Earth observe capsule being accompanied by two brilliant UFOs near moon. Then, when near Earth before landing, large UFO with red lights was observed. Spacecraft, Apollo 17, date December 7 to 19, 1972. Crew, Cernan, Evans, and Smith. Incident, saw UFOs near Earth, close to moon, and in between. Additional confirmation that the Apollo 11 astronauts had indeed experienced some strange moments on their five-day flight to the moon and back comes from a source apparently associated with Anglia TV in London. According to this source, NASA was forced to change the originally intended landing site for the Eagle lander module because it was discovered that the first site was, quote, crawling, presumably with somebody else's space hardware. As evidence, the Anglia source cites the following alleged, quote, deleted bit of conversation obtained through an unnamed intermediary purported to have taken place between astronaut Colonel Edwin Buzz Aldrin and NASA Mission Control sometime prior to the lunar landing on July 20th, 1969. Quote, Aldrin. What was it? What the hell was it? That's all I want to know. Mission Control, what's there? Garble malfunction in the sound. And Mission Control calling Apollo 11. Aldrin. These babies were huge, sir. Enormous. Oh, God, you wouldn't believe it. I'm telling you, there are other spacecraft out here. Lined up on the far side of the crater edge. They're on the moon watching us. You know, the way you can jump on the moon, I would have gone in orbit. Many reports circulated, most of you are aware of them and wonder how much is truth and how much is false. I'm still wondering. It's like science fiction scenario. But one scene was rather convincingly carried out in New Mexico some years ago, and the first scene could be titled as follows. Place, the teletype room of Radio KOAT, Albuquerque, New Mexico. Time, July 7, 1947, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Lydia Sleppy, what a name, who in addition to her other office and administrative duties for radio station KOAT in Albuquerque, New Mexico, was also the teletype operator. She was sitting at her machine at the station at approximately 4 p.m., the date was July 7, 1947. You still don't have the sound right, Joe. Suddenly the phone rang with a message that would affect news reports for the next few days throughout the world, and whose import may not yet be fully apparent. The call from that ringing phone was from Johnny McBoyle, reporter and part owner of sister station KSWS in Roswell, New Mexico, a station which had no teletype of its own, but which frequently used the KOAT machine when it had something to report. This time, his voice was excited. Lydia, get ready for a scoop. We want to get this on the ABC wire right away. Listen to this. A flying saucer has crashed. No, I'm not joking. It crashed near Roswell. I've been there and seen it. It's like a big crumpled dishpan. Some rancher has hauled it under a cattle shelter with his tractor. The army is there. They're going to pick it up. The whole area is now closed off. And get this. They're saying something about little men being on board. Start getting this on the teletype right away while I'm on the phone. Understandably bemused, Lydia placed the phone in the uncomfortable position between ear and shoulder and started to type McBoyle's startling statements into the teletype. But after she had typed only several sentences, the machine suddenly stopped itself. As this is a common occurrence with teletypes for a variety of reasons, Lydia was not concerned, although she had never been cut off the air before in the middle of a transmission. Moving the telephone from her neck to her hand, she informed McBoyle that the teletype had stopped at her end. This time, according to her recollections, he seemed not only excited, but under pressure. And apparently, And apparently, see, you were wrong about me. Speaking to someone else at the same time. His voice seemed strained. Wait a minute, he said. I'll get back to you. Wait. I'll get right back. But he did not. You were wrong about me a second time. But he did not. Instead, the teletype went on again by itself and started addressing Albuquerque or Lydia directly. The sender was not identified, and the tone was formal and curt. Attention, Albuquerque. Can we continue? Get on the telephone.
Is the phone number to use if you live in the United States. That's 1-800-338-3030. If you are calling from South America, the Caribbean, Europe, Mexico, Africa, Canada, or anywhere else in the world, call Colette to area code 818-240-8151. That's 818-240-8151.
Okay, poor Lydia Sleppy. Sitting at her machine in radio station KOAT in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Too hot in here now. Can you find some place in between those two extremes? She was a teletype operator sitting at her machine approximately 4 p.m. The date was July 7, 1947, and I'm reading Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore, The Roswell Incident, written in 1980. The date was July 7, 1947. Suddenly the phone rang with a message that would affect news reports for days throughout the world. The call was from Johnny McBoyle, reporter and part owner of sister station KSWS in Roswell, New Mexico. A station which had no teletype of its own, but which frequently used the KOAT machine when it had something to report. This time his voice was excited. Lydia, get ready for a scoop. We want to get this on the ABC wire right away. Listen to this. A flying saucer has crashed. No, I'm not joking. It crashed near Roswell. I've been there and seen it. It's like a big crumpled dishpan. Some rancher has hauled it under a cattle shelter with his tractor, and the army's there, and they're going to pick it up. The whole area is now closed off, and get this, they're saying something about little men being on board. Start getting this on the teletype right away while I'm on the phone. Understandably bemused, Lydia placed the phone in the uncomfortable position between ear and shoulder and started to type McBoyle's startling statements into the teletype. But after she had typed only several sentences, the machine suddenly stopped itself. As this is a common occurrence with teletypes for a variety of reasons, Lydia was not concerned. Although she had never been cut off the air before in the middle of a transmission. Moving the telephone from her neck to her hand, she informed McBoyle that the teletype had stopped at her end. This time, according to her recollections, he seemed not only excited, but under pressure and apparently speaking to someone else at the same time. His voice seemed strained. "Wait a minute, I'll get back to you. Wait, I'll get right back." But he did not. Instead, the teletype went on again by itself and started addressing Albuquerque or Lydia directly. The sender was not identified, and the tone was formal and curt. "Attention, Albuquerque." That's where I was. That's where we stopped. 1610 called. Generation New York. "Attention, Albuquerque. Do not transmit. Repeat. Do not transmit this message. Stop communication immediately." As Lydia still had McBoyle on the phone, she told him what had just come over the teletype and asked, "What do I do now?" His reply was unexpected. I bet we sell some of these books. "Forget about it. You never heard it. Look, you're not supposed to know. Don't talk about it to anyone." McBoyle later told Lydia Sleppy that he had witnessed a plane which he said was destined for Wright-Patterson, take off with the objects or parts of it on board, but was unable to get anywhere near it because of the tight security maintained by heavily armed guards. Although this was Lydia's last connection with the, quote, happening, she had ample time for subsequent reflection about it, since it was to become a topic of considerable discussion after the return of her boss, Merle Tucker, who had been out of town at the time of the occurrence. Tucker was concerned that his station's involvement in the incident could jeopardize his recent application for an FCC license for a subsidiary station he was preparing to add to his Rio Grande broadcasting network. At about 10 minutes to 10 on the evening of July 2nd, 1947, local hardware dealer Dan Wilmot and his wife were sitting on the front porch of their South Pennsylvania Street home in Roswell, New Mexico, enjoying a cool respite from what had been one of those hot New Mexico summer days. In Wilmot's words, all of a sudden, a big, glowing object zoomed out of the sky from the southeast. It was going northwest toward Corona, New Mexico, at a high rate of speed. Now, this was preceded by a whole series of claimed sightings. This is July 2nd, June 25th, 1947. A saucer-shaped object about one-half the size of the full moon was reported moving south over Silver City, New Mexico, by the local dentist, Dr. R.F. Sessenbauger. June 26th, the next day, 1947, Leon Ottinger, M.D., of Lexington, Kentucky, and three other witnesses reported a large, silver, ball-shaped object, clearly not a balloon or dirigible, traveling at high speed near the edge of the Grand Canyon. June 27th, 1947, John A. Petschy, an electrician at Phelps Dodge Corporation, and other witnesses reported a disc-shaped object overhead and apparently coming to Earth about 10:30 a.m. near Tintown in the vicinity of Bisbee in southeastern Arizona near the New Mexico border. People gonna have to get used to these pauses while I light my cigar or my pipe. June 27th, 1947, Major George B. Wilcox of Warren, Arizona, reported a series of 8 or 9 perfectly spaced discs traveling at high speed with a wobbling motion. He said the discs passed over his house at 3-second intervals heading east and estimated them to be at a height of about 1,000 feet above the mountaintops. June 27th, same day, 1947, a, quote, white disc glowing like an electric light bulb, end quote, was reported to have passed over Pope, New Mexico, by local resident W.C. Dobbs at 9:50 a.m. Minutes later, the same or a similar object was sighted traveling southwest over the White Sands Missile Range by Captain E.B. Detchmende, who reported it to his commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Harold R. Turner. At 10 a.m., Mrs. David Appelzoller of San Miguel, New Mexico, reported that a similar object had passed over that city, again heading southwest. Colonel Turner of White Sands initially reacted by announcing that no rockets had been launched from that base since June 12th. Later, fearing hysteria, he officially, quote, identified the object as a, quote, daytime meteorite. June 28th, the next day, 1947. Captain F. Devine, a pilot flying in the vicinity of Alamogordo, New Mexico, witnessed, quote, a ball of fire with a fiery blue trail behind it, end quote, passed beneath his aircraft and appeared to disintegrate while he watched. June 29th. 1947, next day. Army Air Force pilots conducted a search for an object reported to have fallen near Cliff, New Mexico, sometime in the forenoon, but find nothing but a curious odor in the air. Same day, June 29, 1947, the day after Captain Devine saw the ball of fire disintegrate, a team of naval rocket test experts headed by Dr. C.J. Zone on duty at the White Sands Proving Grounds watched a silvery-colored disc do a series of maneuvers at high altitude over the secret rocket test range. You didn't find the spot, Brad. It's too cold now. June 30, 1947. Next day, 13 silvery disc-shaped objects were observed by a railroad worker named Price, traveling one after another over Albuquerque, New Mexico. Initially heading south, they changed course abruptly to east and then reversed dramatically to west before disappearing. Price alerted his neighbors, and the entire neighborhood rushed out of their houses to lie on their lawns and observe the maneuvers in the sky above them. Same day, June 30, 1947, as reported from the Tucumcari, New Mexico Daily News on July 9th. Quote, Mrs. Helen Hardeen, employee of Quay County Abstract Company, reported Tuesday, July 8th, that she saw a flying saucer from her front porch about 11 p.m. June 30th, traveling from east to west at high speed. She said it looked to be about half the size of the full moon, with a slight yellow cast. She watched it for about 6 seconds, low in the sky, and going down outside of town rather than close in. She at first thought it was a meteor, but noticed a whirling motion as it neared the ground. Also, it was not falling as fast as meteors do. July 1, 1947. Max Hood, an executive of the Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce, reported seeing a bluish disk zigzagging across the northwestern sky over Albuquerque. July 1 to 6, 1947. Seven separate reports of flying disks over northern Mexico, ranging from Mexicali to Juarez. July 1, 1947. Mr. and Mrs. Frank Munn reported witnessing a large object moving east over Phoenix about 9 p.m. July 2, 1947. About 10 minutes to 10 on the evening of July 2, 1947, and this is where I was, local hardware dealer Dan Wilmot and his wife were sitting on the front porch of their South Penn Street home in Roswell, New Mexico. All of a sudden, in Wilmot's words, a big, glowing object zoomed out of the sky from the southeast. It was going northwest toward Corona, New Mexico, at a high rate of speed. Somewhat startled, Wilmot and his wife ran out into their yard to watch as an oval object shaped, quote, like two inverted saucers faced mouth to mouth and glowing as if lit from the inside passed over their house and out of sight to the northwest in 40 to 50 seconds. Although Wilmot described the mysterious object as having been completely silent, Mrs. Wilmot later said she thought she had heard a slight swishing sound for a brief moment as the object passed overhead. Concerned that he might be leaving himself open to ridicule, Wilmot described by the Roswell Daily Record as one of the most respected and reliable citizens in town, kept silent about his experience for nearly a week in hopes that someone else would come out and tell about having seen one. But nobody told Wilmot anything that might corroborate his experience until on July 8th, an unusual release to the press came from the public information officer at the Roswell base. In view of the ensuing excitement, it may have occurred later to Wilmot that he had seen a preview of an incident which later developed into a well-kept and continuing secret, at least as far as the public was concerned. It was not treated as such when it first appeared. Or first happened. On July 8, one day after Mrs. Sleppy's unusual incident with the TWX teletype machine, Lieutenant Walter Hout, public information officer at the Roswell Army Air Base, acting on information beginning to filter into the Roswell Air Base, jumped the gun in a burst of excitement and enthusiastically issued the following release to members of the press without first bothering to obtain the authorization of his base commander, Colonel William Blanchard, an oversight he was to be made painfully aware of later. quote, and this is the release, Roswell Army Air Base, Roswell, New Mexico, 8th July, 1947 a.m. The many rumors regarding the flying disc became a reality yesterday when the intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group of the 8th Air Force Roswell Army Airfield was fortunate enough to gain possession of a disc through the cooperation of one of the local ranchers and the sheriff's office of Chavez County. The flying object landed on a ranch near Roswell sometime last week. Not having phone facilities, the rancher stored the disc until such time as he was able to contact the sheriff's office, who in turn notified Major Jesse A. Marcel of the 509th Bomb Group Intelligence Office. Continuing, the release said, quote, action was immediately taken and the disc was picked up at the rancher's home. It was inspected at the Roswell Army Airfield and subsequently loaned by Major Marcel to higher headquarters. End of release. This release, which was enthusiastically picked up by the Associated Press and the New York Times Wire Service and others, managed to appear in numerous newspapers across the United States, as well as a number of foreign journals, including the prestigious London Times. The day before the release from the Army base, an AP release went out over the wire service, Dateline San Francisco, July 7th, under the headline, Flying Saucers Seen in Most States Now, dealing with a phenomenal increase in UFO sightings in the United States during the previous 2 weeks. It almost served as an introduction to the incident, which would attain worldwide preeminence the next day. The Roswell Daily Record rushed into print on July 8th with the following report. If you want me to continue, get on the telephone. Roswell Daily Record rushed into print on July 8th with the following report, captioned, RAAF captures flying saucer in Roswell region. No details of flying discs are revealed. The following article implied both a solution of the flying saucer controversy and a suggestion that the AAF was already involved in the beginnings of cover-up. Pertinent points of the article follow. Quote, the intelligence officer of the 509th Bombardment Group at Roswell Army Airfield announced at noon today that the field had come into possession of a flying saucer. According to information released by the department over authority of Major J.A. Marcel, intelligence officer, the disc was recovered on a ranch in the Roswell vicinity after an unidentified rancher had notified Sheriff George Wilcox here that he had found the instrument on his premises. Major Marcel and a detail from his department went to the ranch and recovered the disc. It was stated. After the intelligence office here had inspected the instrument, it was flown by aircraft to higher headquarters. The intelligence office stated that no details of the saucer's construction or its appearance had been revealed. End of those parts of that article. Another article in the same July 8th issue of the Roswell Daily Record reported that the operator and pilots of a private airfield at Carrizozo, about 35 miles southwest of the Brazil crash site, claimed to have seen a similar object in flight, according to the article. Quote, Mark Sloan, operator of the Carrizozo flying field, reported a flying saucer sped over the field at about a 4,000 to a 6,000 foot altitude. Sloan said the phenomenon was observed by himself. Grady Warren, flying instructor, and Nolan Lovelace, Ray Schaefer, and another man, all pilots. He made this description, said, quote, when we first noticed it at about 10 a.m., we thought it resembled a feather because it was oscillating. Then we noticed its great speed and decided it was a flying saucer. Our guesses are that it was moving at between 200 and 600 miles per hour. It passed over the field and almost directly up from southwest to northwest and was in sight in all only about 10 seconds. Here's a full copy of the Roswell paper. Tuesday, July 8th, 1947. With the article, no details of flying disc are revealed. Now, it could, of course, be suspected that Sloan had latched on to the incident to give some publicity to his flying field. But later it was to appear that numerous other witnesses had heard or seen something very unusual in the sky over Roswell around the time of the landing of a still unidentified flying object. Perhaps the weather had something to do with the sightings and the alleged crash. Some 75 miles to the northwest, one of the worst lightning storms to strike the area in a long time was beginning to rage over the bleak New Mexico landscape. Lightning storms had occasionally brought down aircraft in the past. The sketchy information used by Lieutenant Haupt to write his initial news release was hardly sufficient to supply the press with certain additional details of possible crucial importance, which numerous other witnesses, including ranchers, soldiers, a civil engineer, a group of student archaeologists, and law enforcement officers had observed at two distinctly different sites within the area that were apparently connected with the same crash. These reputedly included a large flying saucer and the remains of half a dozen or so humanoid creatures, pale in skin coloring, about 4 feet tall and dressed in a kind of one-piece jumpsuit uniform. Nor did they mention a great quantity of highly unusual wreckage, much of it metallic in nature, apparently originating from the same object and described by Major Marcel as, quote, nothing made on this earth, end quote. Neither was any mention made to the press of later information reported by witnesses concerning certain columns of hieroglyphic-like writings or recordings on a wooden-like substance that was not wood and similar unknown lettering on the control panels of the disc or saucer. Now, Lieutenant Haupt had ample opportunity to regret even the small amount of information he had given out is now evident. Almost immediately, a news blackout descended over Roswell while higher authorities as far away as the Pentagon decided what the next move would be. Several hours later, a new bit of information was suddenly released. It now appeared that the object was merely a crashed weather balloon. Most papers copied this new information, with the notable exception of the Washington Post, which referred rather pointedly to a news blackout. Boring you?
No, sir.
Meanwhile, Brigadier General Roger M. Ramey, commander of the 8th Air Force District at Fort Worth, was alerted by a phone call from Lieutenant General Hoyt Vandenberg, Deputy Chief of the Air Force, that pieces of the object were on the Roswell Air Base, now called the Walker Air Force Base. General Ramey at once called Colonel Blanchard and made known his extreme displeasure, as well as that of General Vandenberg, for Blanchard's having initiated the press release. He then directed that the Roswell portion of the wreckage be immediately loaded aboard a B-29. With two generals breathing down his neck, Colonel Blanchard lost no time in ordering Major Marcel personally to fly this material to the General's headquarters at Carswell Air Force Base, Fort Worth, Texas, for his examination before flying it on to Wright-Patterson Field in Dayton, Ohio, where it would undergo the further analysis prescribed for it by General Vandenberg himself. Ramey then went on the air on a hookup hastily patched out of a Fort Worth radio station to nervously assure the public that the crashed flying dish apparently, the quote indicates he was stuttering on radio, was really nothing more than the remains of a downed weather balloon, and that the whole thing was due only to a case of mistaken identity. Quote, he said, there is no such gadget as a flying disc known to the Army, he said somberly, and then hastily added the qualification, at least not at this level. After the broadcast, in response to a question from a group of still skeptical Fort Worth press reporters about where the remains of the alleged weather disc or weather device were at that moment, Ramey snapped irritably, it's in my office and it will probably stay right there. He then repeated for the reporters what he had just said on the air. The special flight to Wright Field has been canceled, gentlemen. The whole affair has been most unfortunate, but in light of the excitement that has been stirred up lately about these so-called flying discs, it's not surprising. Now let's all go home and call it an evening. While some members of the press may have suspected that Ramey was shading the truth, they had no proof. However, an interesting comment on this incident was supplied during a September 9th, 1979 interview with General Ramey's former adjutant, Colonel Thomas Jefferson DuBose, now a retired brigadier general. Speaking from a comfortable margin of 32 years after the event, he observed that there had been received, quote, orders from on high to ship the material from Roswell directly to Wright Field by special plane. He added that the general, Ramey that is, was in complete charge, and the rest of the officers and men involved, quote, just followed orders. The general was most concerned that the large number of press reporters present be, quote, taken off his back in a hurry. The weather balloon story was a fabrication designed to accomplish that task and put out the fire at the same time. He did not recall who first suggested the weather balloon explanation, but thinks it may have been Ramey himself. Colonel, now General, DuBose, is the man pictured with Ramey on page 33 posing for reporters on the floor of Ramey's office with the hastily substituted wreckage of a real Rowan weather balloon. Here's the picture. A striking, wait a minute, only 9 months later, DuBose was to become chief of staff of the 8th Air Force at Fort Worth. That's almost as good as some of these broads posing for Playboy. Pictures pay off. A striking example of how command can orchestrate new policy with original reports, even if it entails a certain modification of what has been reported, is afforded by the case of Warrant Officer Irving Newton. At the time of the Roswell incident, Newton was in charge of the base weather office and flight services at the Carswell-Fort Worth Air Base in Texas. As Newton recollects, he had neither seen nor heard anything about the Roswell incident on July 7th, but on the night of July 8th, as he was working in the weather office, the phone rang. It was General Ramey. The general ordered Newton to report to his office immediately. Newton, in spite of a certain urgency in the general's tone, nevertheless found the courage to inform the general that he was the only man on duty in the weather office, and as such, he was also in charge of flight control operations that evening. To Newton's mildly couched protest, the general replied with a decisive command flare, "Get your ass over here in 10 minutes. If you can't get a car, Commandeer, the first one that comes along on my orders." When Newton got to his destination, he was briefed by a colonel to the effect that an object had been found by a major in Roswell and that the general had decided that it was really a weather balloon and wanted him, Newton, to identify it as such. After this hurried briefing, Newton was ushered into a room filled with reporters and photographers where he was handed several pieces of what he immediately recognized as material belonging to a Rowan-type balloon, although somewhat deteriorated. A number of other pieces were laid out on brown paper on the floor. While the examination was taking place, a series of photographs were taken of the general and his aide. Newton said in an interview July 1979, quote, "It was cut and dried. I had sent up thousands of them, and there's no doubt that what I was given were parts of a balloon. I was later told that the major from Roswell had identified the stuff as a flying saucer, but that the general had been suspicious of this identification from the beginning, and that's why I'd been called in." Question. But wouldn't the people at Roswell have been able to identify a balloon on their own? Answer, they certainly should have. It was a regular Rowan balloon. They must have seen hundreds of them. Question. What happened after your identification of the object? When I had identified it as a balloon, it was dismissed. Can you describe the fabric? Was it easy to tear? Certainly. You'd have to be careful not to tear it. The metal involved was like an extremely thin Alcoa wrap that was very flimsy. In this connection, we note that Major Marcel, as well as others, were insistent about the great strength of the bits of metallic material they found, how it could not be torn or even dented by sledgehammer blows. And of course, a farmer pulled it into a shed with a tractor. It seems fairly evident that the wreckage did not, in spite of official second thoughts, come from a Rowan balloon. Another telling error on the part of Ramey's office can be found in the initial news releases identifying the Roswell wreckage as having come from a balloon. It is important to note here that in 1947 there were two distinct types of Rowan devices in use. The Rowan Target, ML-306, and the Rowan Sond, AN/AMT-4. As Newton and certainly any other competent weather officer of the time would have known, only one of these. The Rowan Target incorporated metallic foil as part of its design. the raw and sewn consisted only of a 100 to 200 gram neoprene balloon attached to a small radio transmitter. Yet the news release from Ramey's office, which was clearly written before Newton's examination of the device, notice that before Newton's examination, the photo here of Ramey shows him holding the news release in his hand, written before Newton identified it. The news release, which was clearly written before Newton's examination of the device, note that the photo of Ramey on page 33 shows him holding a copy of that very document, appears ignorant of this all-important fact and identifies the wreckage as debris from a raw and sonde. The error was later corrected in subsequent releases, but appears to have escaped the attention of the press. You want me to continue?
Yes,
sir. Pretty interesting. The initial reports about the landing of a flying disc had already been widely spread by radio stations other than KSWS and Roswell, doubtless based on the first press release and in spite of the subsequent news blackout. Flight Major Huey Green of the British RAF, then en route by car from California to Philadelphia, was driving through New Mexico during July 1947. He remembers clearly what he heard on his car radio. As I drove through New Mexico from west to east, I kept hearing these reports about a downed saucer on local stations as I came within the radius of each one. I was especially interested in the reports because of being in the RAF myself and remembering the wartime flap about Foo Fighters, the flying saucers of those days. The radio stations I was listening to were so on edge that they kept interrupting their regular broadcast to give the latest developments. I am certain that one of the news broadcasts commented on the fact that the sheriff and his men were proceeding towards the field of the crash within sight of the wreckage. I heard more reports as I entered the next state, and there was further material, as I remember, in the press. But when I got to Philadelphia, there was nothing at all about it in the papers or on the radio. I began asking reporter friends about it, but they replied that they knew about it but heard that it had been hushed up. As it was impossible to cover up the incident completely, a lively legend, if legend it is, has persisted to this day. You want to continue? Go on telephone. I'm reading Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore, The Roswell Incident. I don't expect to finish it. I just expect the book to sell out of all bookstores. Probably before we have a chance to get any for our bookstore. Witnesses speak, the town remembers. Barney Barnett, a resident of Socorro, New Mexico, a civil engineer working for the federal government in soil conservation, was one of the first witnesses to arrive at the site of the fallen saucer sometime in the morning of July 3, 1947. While living in New Mexico, Barney and his wife Ruth had become close friends of L.W. Vern Maltese and his wife Jean Svedmark Maltese. Vern was on assignment with the military in New Mexico at this time. In February 1950, during a visit by the Malteses to Socorro, Barnett told his friends an extraordinary story. Before telling them, however, he cautioned them not to repeat it. Barnett claimed to have personally witnessed a flying saucer crash in the Socorro area, that he had seen it and seen dead bodies that were not human beings. Then the area was quickly sealed off and the bodies and wreckage removed by the military. Although 3 decades have passed since Barnett told his strange tale to the Malteses, they remember it very well, especially as it was underscored by the many UFO sightings reported in New Mexico at the time. Both the Malteses spoke highly of Barnett's character. He was older than they were, very conservative, quite sure of himself. Definitely not the type to go about spreading wild rumors. But the Malteses recalled Barnett definitely said he had seen the thing on the ground. According to the Malteses, this is what Barnett told them. To you that watch on television, now here's a picture of Barnett's World War I Army ID. And then in front of his Socorro, New Mexico house in 1945, 2 years before the incident. This is what he told them. I was out on assignment working near Magdalena, New Mexico, one morning when light reflecting off some sort of large metallic object caught my eye. Thinking that a plane may have crashed during the night, I went over to where it was, about a mile, perhaps a mile, and a quarter. Perhaps a mile and a quarter away on flat desert land. By the time I got there, I realized it wasn't a plane at all, but some sort of metallic, disc-shaped object about 25 or 30 feet across. While I was looking at it and trying to decide what it was, some other people came up from the other direction and began looking around it, too. They told me later that they were part of an archaeological research team from some eastern university. Later determined, because they're part of the witnesses, too, in the record to follow, from the University of Pennsylvania. And that they, too, had first thought a plane had crashed. They were all over the place looking at the wreck. Barnett's story continues. I noticed that they were standing around looking at some dead bodies that had fallen to the ground. I think there were other dead bodies in the machine, which was a kind of metallic instrument of some sort, a kind of disc. It was not all that big. It seemed to be made of metal that looked like dirty stainless steel. The machine had been split open by explosion or impact. Am I boring you? I tried to get close to see what the bodies were like. They were all dead as far as I could see, and there were bodies inside and outside the vehicle. The ones outside had been tossed out by the impact. They were like humans, but they were not humans. The heads were round, the eyes were small, and they had no hair. The eyes were oddly spaced. They were quite small by our standards, and their heads were larger in proportion to their bodies than ours. Their clothing seemed to be one piece and gray in color. You couldn't see any zippers, belts, or buttons. They seemed to be all males, and there were a number of them. I was close enough to touch them, but I didn't. I was escorted away before I could look at them anymore. While we were looking at them, a military officer drove up in a truck with a driver and took control. He told everybody that the army was taken over and to get out of the way. Other military personnel came up and cordoned off the area. We were told to leave the area and not to talk to anyone, whatever, about what we had seen. that it was our patriotic duty to remain silent. Mr. Maltese interrupted at this point to add, quote, Barnett said that he was out in the field when he saw this thing and that there were other individuals there with him. I think he said the individuals he talked to there were from the University of Pennsylvania. They were doing some digs in the New Mexico area and were involved with this thing only because they were in the area when it crashed. The object was a metallic-like instrument of some sort. The individuals were quite small by our standards. Their heads were larger in proportion to their bodies compared to our human standards. And he says, I remember vividly that Barnett had been told to say absolutely nothing. And he had not done so for several years until he shared his experience with us in 1950. We were very close friends, perhaps the closest he had. Barnett called the creatures males. There was no mention of females. There were a number of them. But I can't remember how many he said there were. He repeated several times that their eyes were small and oddly spaced. The object was soon moved away from the crash site. They brought in a large truck. Whoever was involved with it asked the spectators to leave. This included the University of Pennsylvania people. Everyone was told to leave the area and not to talk about it to anyone because to do so would be unpatriotic. When asked if she recalled in what part of New Mexico Barnett had said the crash had occurred, Mrs. Maltese answered, No, I don't recall exactly. It was somewhere out of Socorro. He may have said exactly, but I don't recall. I remember he said it was prairie. The flats is the way he put it. Definitely not in the mountainous area. As Barney Barnett's reported version of the incident is so complete and ties in so neatly with other reports, it is pertinent to consider his reputation in the area and whether or not he was especially imaginative or visionary. Grady Landon, Barney Barnett, worked as an engineer in the area for the U.S. Soil Conservation Service for 20 years until his retirement in 1957. Veteran of World War I, second lieutenant, and past commander of the American Legion post in Mosquero, New Mexico, a model of a conservative, respected citizen. Holm Burnsom Jr., bank executive, former mayor of Socorro, and son of Holm Burnsom Sr., former U.S. senator from New Mexico, was not unaware of the atomic or space age as his cattle were exposed to fallout from the first 1945 A-bomb test at Alamogordo, which caused them to turn spotted white and subsequently to be shipped to Oak Ridge National Laboratory for study. When interviewed by Moore, too hot in here again. In 1979, he immediately recalled having known Barnett quite well and spoke highly of him. Asked about the possibility that Barnett's crash UFO account may have been true, Burnsom replied, quote, a tale like that would have been fantastic, all right, but I would have to say that anything he said would have to be true to the best of his knowledge. Lee Garner, former cowboy and later sheriff of Socorro County, remembers Barney Barnett favorably and especially remembers the archaeological expedition, doubtless because of his own interest in Indian archaeology. He thought the expedition was from Michigan, but said there may have been Pennsylvania students involved with it. John Greenwald, a former federal government employee and now retired farmer in Socorro County, recalled that Barnett worked primarily in a map area to the west of Socorro called the Plains of San Agustin, also called locally the Flats, and believed that the incident had taken place there. J.F. Fleck Danley of Magdalena, New Mexico, was more specific. Barnett was an engineer and worked under me out of Magdalena in the 1940s and early 50s. He was a good man, one of the most honest men I ever knew. Questioned by Moore, one of the authors of the book. Did Barnett ever say anything about a flying saucer? Reply. From Danley. Yes, there was one time. And again, the character of Barney is not conclusive because the reporters from the Maltesers. But now comes corroboration by J.F. Fleck Danley. Did Barnett ever say anything about a flying saucer? Yes. There was one time Barney came into the office one afternoon all kind of excited and said to me, quote, "You know those flying saucer things they've been talking about, Fleck? Well, they're real." Then he said something about he's just had a look at one of them. I was real busy at the time and wasn't in any mood to buy a story like that, so I just turned around to him and said, "Bull blank." Went back to work. He didn't say blank, though. All he told me was that he saw it. I wasn't prepared to believe it at the time, and after I'd said, "Bull blank," he didn't explain anything else about it. I got to thinking about it later that maybe I shouldn't have been so rough with him because he wasn't the sort to go around making up stories like that. And when I asked him about it a day or so later, all he said was out on the flats that it looked like a saucer and that he didn't care to talk about it anymore. Fleck felt he could remember the date of the incident if given time to think about it. In a subsequent interview conducted in his living room some 4 months later, he chuckled and said, "Yes, I recall it now. It had to be sometime in the early summer of 1947. Perhaps some of the most important testimony in the matter of the crash disc comes from Major, now Lieutenant Colonel, Jesse A. Marcel, ranking staff officer in charge of intelligence at the Roswell Army Base at the time of the incident. Marcel, now retired and living in Houma, I guess that's the way you pronounce it, Louisiana, had been flying since 1928 and, in his own words, was familiar with virtually everything that flies. As one of the few cartographers familiar with both the making and interpreting of aerial maps before World War II, he was sent to intelligence school with the Army Air Force following Pearl Harbor and proved to be so capable a student that upon completion of training, he was retained as instructor. And another long speech about his qualifications, include being shot down in the war. Toward the end of the war, Marcel was chosen to become part of the 509th Bomb Wing of the U.S. Army Air Force, the world's only atomic bomb group at the time and one of the few elite groups in the U.S. military where all officers and enlisted men were literally handpicked for their jobs and required high security clearances. And you've monkeyed with my mic upstairs again, ruined it. As a part of this group in 1946, he was instrumental in handling security for the 1946 Kwajalein atom bomb tests and was awarded a commendation to the U.S. Navy for his work. In recent interviews, 1979, he remembered some interesting details concerning his own connection with the Roswell incident and the intriguing possibility that either there was a second disc that exploded in the air or that material fell after an explosion from the disc described in Barnett's account before that object apparently crashed to the earth some distance to the west. Question. At that interview in 1979. Major Marcel, did you personally see a crashed UFO? Answer. I saw a lot of wreckage, but no complete machine. Whatever it was had to have exploded in the air above ground level. It had disintegrated before it hit the ground. The wreckage was scattered over an area of about 3/4 mile long and several hundred feet wide. Question. How did the Roswell base know about the crash on Brazel's ranch? Answer. We heard about it on July 7th. When we got a call from the county sheriff's office at Roswell. I was eating lunch at the officer's club when the call came through saying that I should go out and talk to Brazel. The sheriff said that Brazel had told him that something had exploded over Brazel's ranch and that there was a lot of debris scattered around. I finished my lunch, went into town to talk to this fellow. When I heard what he had to say, I decided that this was a matter that had better be brought to the attention of the colonel Colonel Blanchard, that is, right away and let him decide what ought to be done. I wanted Brazel to accompany me back to the base with his truck, but he said he had some things to do first and could he meet me somewhere in an hour or so. I arranged for him to meet me at the sheriff's office and went back to see the colonel. In my discussion with the colonel, we determined that a downed aircraft of some unusual sort might be involved, so the colonel said I'd better get over there and to take whatever I needed and go. I and a CIC, that is Counterintelligence Corps agent from West Texas by the name of Cavett, followed this man out to his ranch with me driving my staff car and Cavett in a Jeep carryall. There were almost no roads, and at spots we literally had to go right across country. It was as close to the middle of nowhere as you could get. Anyhow, we got there very late in the afternoon and had to spend the night with this fellow. All we had to eat was some cold pork and beans and some crackers. Brazil lived on the southeast side of Corona, quite far. The closest town was 30 miles away. He lived in a dinky house on a sheep ranch. No radio, no telephone, lived there by himself most of the time. His wife and kids lived in Tularosa or Carrizozo, so the children would have some place to attend school. There's a note, it was Tularosa. It seemed to me that Brazel told me that he thought he had heard an odd explosion late in the evening, several days earlier, during an electrical storm, but paid no special attention to it at the time because he'd attributed it to just a freak part of the storm. He didn't find the wreckage until the next morning. On Saturday, July 5th, 1947, Brazil went into town, Corona. While he was there, he heard stories about flying saucers having been seen all over the area. He began to think that's what had come down on his ranch, but I don't know whether he said anything about it to anyone at the time. On Sunday, July 6th, Brazel decided he'd better go into town and report this to someone. When he got there, he went to the Chaves County Sheriff's Office and told the story to the sheriff. It was the sheriff, George Wilcox, the 509th officer reported, who called me at the base. I was eating lunch at the time. I had just sat down when the phone rang. Question. Do you think that what you saw was a weather balloon? Answer. It was not. I was pretty well acquainted with most everything that was in the air at that time, both ours and foreign. I was also acquainted with virtually every type of weather observation or radar tracking device being used by either the civilians or the military. It was definitely not a weather or tracking device, nor was it any sort of plane or missile. What it was, we didn't know. We just picked up the fragments. It was something I'd never seen before or since, for that matter. I didn't know what it was, but it certainly wasn't anything built by us, and it most certainly wasn't any weather balloon. I used to fish North Fork Feather River up above Orville, California. There were a couple of bearded, smelly, ugly fishermen that lived in a cabin up there along the stream. We used to stop and talk to them as we were fishing the river. I still remember as a teenager, they became famous. Their big day in the sun. Some saucer had landed on a gravel bar, and little short men had got out and talked to them in a language they didn't understand and got back in the saucer and flew away. They were front page news, the Orville Mercury. The news picked it up all over. We've all heard these stories. There's a lot of discrepancies here in this report, too. I mean, I keep waiting for the rancher to find bodies. And where does he do what the other report said, which is hook his tractor on it and pull it into a shed? But you should read police reports of people trying to report an accident. Is there truth in the midst of all these varying stories? That's what this book's about. Do you think it was a weather balloon? No, it wasn't. Can you describe the materials that you found on the site? Answer. There was all kinds of stuff, small beams about 3/8 or half inch square with some sort of hieroglyphics on them that nobody could decipher. These looked something like balsa wood and were of about the same weight, except that they were not wood at all. They were very hard, although flexible, and would not burn. There was a great deal of unusual parchment-like substance, which was brown in color and extremely strong, and a great number of small pieces of metal like tinfoil, except it wasn't tinfoil. I was interested in electronics and kept looking for something that resembled instruments or electronic equipment, but I didn't find anything. One of the other fellows, Cabot, I think, found a black metallic-looking box several inches square, and there was no apparent way to open this, since it didn't appear to be an instrument package of any sort. It too was very lightweight. We threw it in with the rest of the stuff. I don't know what eventually happened to the box. This is the Air Force man talking. But it went along with the rest of the material we eventually took to Fort Worth. What was especially interesting about the material? One thing that impressed me about the debris was the fact that a lot of it looked like parchment. It had little numbers with symbols that we had to call hieroglyphics because I couldn't understand them. They could not be read. They were just like symbols, something that meant something, and they were not all the same, but the same general pattern, I would say. They were pink and purple. They looked like they were painted on. These little numbers could not be broken, could not be burned. I even took my cigarette lighter and tried to burn the material we found that resembled parchment and balsa, but it wouldn't burn, wouldn't even smoke. But something that is even more astounding is that the pieces of metal that we brought back were so thin, just like the tinfoil in a pack of cigarettes. I didn't pay too much attention to that at first until one of the boys came to me and said, "You know that metal that was in there? I tried to bend the stuff and it won't bend. I even tried it with a sledgehammer. You can't make a dent in it." This particular piece of metal was about 2 feet long, maybe a foot wide. It was so light, it weighed practically nothing. That was true of all the material that was brought up. It weighed practically nothing. It was so thin. So I tried to bend the stuff. We did all we could to bend it. It would not bend. You could not tear it or cut it either. We even tried making a dent in it with a 16-pound sledgehammer, and there was still no dent in it. It's still a mystery to me what the whole thing was. Now, by bend, I mean crease. It was possible to flex this stuff back and forth, even to wrinkle it. But you could not put a crease in it that would stay, nor could you dent it at all. One of the fellows tried to put some of the pieces together like a jigsaw puzzle. He managed to get about 10 square feet together. But it wasn't enough to get any idea of the general shape of the object itself. Whatever it was big. What'd you do with the material you'd picked up? Answer. Well, let's go back to the press and the radio people. How'd they get involved? We all go over that again. It was the public information officer, Howard, I believe his name was, who called the AP and later wrote the press release. I heard he wasn't authorized to do this, and I believe he is severely reprimanded for it. I think all the way from Washington. We had calls from everywhere, all over the world. It was General Ramey who put up the cover story about the balloon just to get the press off our backs. The press was told it was just a balloon, that the flight to Iraq, Patterson, was canceled. But all that really happened was that I was removed from the flight and someone else took it up to Wright Patterson. I wasn't even allowed to talk to the press except to say what the general had told me to say. They all wanted to ask me questions. I couldn't tell them anything. It gets more interesting, too. Do I hear more? Well, you might want to go buy the book. The Roswell Incident, Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore. Go and tell them.